Good afternoon. This is Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, and this is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 17 April 2024, and that makes it a Wednesday on my calendar, and I'm sure yours as well. Now, today, we're going to continue in our block of immune cell biochemistry by doing lecture number 6 in T lymphocyte membrane biochem. So, let's get started. First of all, let's do a bit of a review. From my view, my viewpoint, biochemical systems are best understood as events in sequence. That's certe in ordine, involving a molecular memory, which is retaining events in the past. That would be in Latin, preterita. Events present through apprehending, that would be susceptionem, and events in the future through faculty of imagination, and that would be previsionem. So no better illustration is the T-cell-mediated immune response, where and when there are a priori events that are realized nunc existentium, now, and continue, of course, a posteriori. So you see why I'm going through this initial series of propositions to remind you how significant living systems are as being described as events. Events are everything we live through. And because we're living, that's how our lens to our world operates. But when we use that lens and we turn it on living systems, it's extremely important to comprehend fully that you're looking at an event that is constantly changing. And so I bring in some Latin terms so that you try, so you can focus on what happens before, during, and after a given biochemical change. Because all three of those components are necessary to, number one, understand what's occurring. And number two, when there is a pathology or there is some kind of disruption in the system that may require medical attention, which we talk about often in authentic biochemistry. So for example, pharmacotherapy, surgery, lifestyle change, any of those, right? We have to understand that the introduction of any kind of therapy within an eventual process can have effects distal and proximal to the presentation we're trying to control. And so you might ask a question, well, how can affecting something here and now, right? What's occurring right when it's happening, the nunc existentium, have an effect on the past? Well, what I mean by that is all of the a priori events, all of the rearrangement of the proteins in the membrane, for example, because of lipid raft mobility, and then the interaction of the lipids with those individual polypeptides, so that was generated is a platform of an immune synapse between an antigen-presenting cell and, for example, the T helper cell, T effector cell, that a priori system that's already arranged will be affected by whatever's occurring now if what we are doing with our intervention with a therapy alters the normal flow of remedy, which the immune system is geared and arranged and organized to obtain and maintain. So when there's a therapy that's introduced during a process targeting, say, an individual polypeptide, which we think may be a good target because it seems to be associated with an oncogenic event, for example, you must understand that that oncogenic event occurred within that ordered a priori network. And then what happened, you know, as a sequelae to that is the presentation we're observing and trying to intervene. But that all of that a priori network will then be altered for all subsequent event ontologies that will lead into the future. Now we've changed what the future will be, right? Because we're starting to have an effect when you add a therapy to what could be epigenetic signatures that were already laid down, normally regulating a stress response, an immune response, you see? Those epigenetic signatures could be altered in such a way that while this event is still occurring, any new pathophysiological or normal remedial physiological responses can be retailored back at the level of transcription, translation, post-translational modification. See? That's the point I'm trying to make. And that's why living systems are so complex to study. And you need to have that window of opportunity to take the time to understand the event ontologies that are always in place. So for this afternoon, after that introduction, I'd like to discuss some clinical associations, thus introducing hematologic malignancies, which of course are cancers that arise in the blood or in the lymphatic system. So blood cancers or leukemias start when bone marrow produces abnormal leukocytes, also abnormal red blood cells and abnormal platelets, all of which might be growing and dividing without control. Okay, so when I say abnormal, that means a potential for proliferation. So these cells, which cannot function normally if they are growing and dividing without normal maintenance control, could then crowd out the normal cells and therefore make a presentation that is recognized as illness. So lymphomas develop from the cells, in this case, lymphocytes, that make up the immune system, at least the acquired arm of the immune system. Whereas myelomas occur in the cells in the bone marrow. And their response, and often that's associated with the cells, the B cells, that are generating immunoglobulins, otherwise known as antibodies. Okay? So leukemia typically originates in bone marrow, and it spreads through bloodstream, while lymphoma usually originates in the lymph node or the spleen, and it spreads through, of course, the lymphatic system. Okay, so those are two other differences. Now, I want to remind you back at the level of hematopoiesis, start off with stem cells. Hematopoietic stem cells that differentiate and mature into erythrocytes, megakaryocytes, and immune cells. And the immune cells are going to be myeloid, lymphoid, or monocytic. And they're going to be either, again, in the bone marrow, initiating the bone marrow's naive cells, or in the lymphatic tissues. Now, any kind of genetic mutation, such as what is found often in these malignancies, chromosomal translocations, chromosomal deletions, indeed, single point mutations, and most importantly for our discussions in authentic biochemistry, because we try to emphasize this, epigenetic signature alterations. Any of those can corrupt the maturation of the stem cells across all those different stages of hematopoiesis. And what that will cause is an uncontrolled, potentially an uncontrolled proliferation of immature leukemic immune cells. So leukemia refers to that clonal expansion in those white blood cells in circulating blood, and also with certain lymphoid malignancies, abnormal cellular proliferation in, of course, the lymphatic tissue. Now, lymphomas, of course, because they're genetic events, right? Cellular events, they're going to be neoplasms. And they occur with the two lymphocyte lines, B cells and T cells. Now, typically, lymphomas present as a malignant mass in lymphatic tissue, whereas leukemias are generally classified into subtypes based on cell lineage, and that will include lymphocytic or myeloid, and stage of maturation arrest during the development, during hematopoiesis, you see, coming all the way from an acute response, a corruption that happens abruptly, or chronic, which means there's going to be a family of incompletely differentiated, therefore immature cells in the system. Okay. I was going to say circulation, but I'm going to say in the system. So mature lymphoid neoplasms are classed according to three groups. And I know all of you clinicians know these. Mature B-cell neoplasms, mature T or NK neoplasms. You also have Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that, of course, acronym is HL. So you have B and T NK cell neoplasms comprising non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. Got it? Those are called NHLs. And then you have a heterogeneous group of some 60 different clonal subtypes. So Hodgkin's lymphoma arises from B cells, but it can be distinguished from non-Hodgkin's lymphomas morphologically by the presence of a specific type of clonal tumor cell called the Reed-Sternberg. And they're easy to pick up on microscopy. They're large multinucleated cells. Those are the Reed-Sternberg clonal tumor cells, which are propagating. Okay. And again, that's in the NHL, the non-Hodgkin lymphomas. Now, let's go back and talk about lipid rash. You know, we're doing a dialectical series of lectures here, like we always do in authentic biochemistry. Remember that lipid rafts, if you haven't already memorized this and could give a lecture on your own, are essentially ordered membrane trafficking domains that are assembled because of a specific class of molecular species, are sphingolipids, glycerophospholipids, plasmalogens, which is a subtype of glycerophospholipids, cholesterol, and of course, families of polypeptides. Okay. And remember that they were first described because of trying to solubilize intracellular lipid membranous fragments and finding that solubilization in cold, because normally these things are done at 4 degrees, non-ionic detergents maintained a floating supernatant upon centrifugation that were first described as rafts. And some of that floating material after centrifugation, right, after sedimentation, still floating, had polypeptide. And then there were lighter fractions that were higher in lipid, right? Much the same way that lipoproteins were first discovered. But this is all intracellular, you understand? So with intact cells, the membrane lipid rafts are known to cross-link with antibodies so that there are, when the antibody, monoclonal antibody, for example, that is directed to the protein, you're going to have co-assimilation between lipid and protein fractions. And those are going to be all deposited on those rafts, and as it turns out, in specific sequences, right? The interdigitation is absolute there. There isn't a randomness, a stochasticism about that. The membrane lipid component and the membrane protein component are arranged specifically during the synthesis of the lipid raft, the maturation thereof, and then the translocation, and ultimately the fusing to other membrane fractions, endomembranous, on the road to plasma membrane, right? Of course. Okay. So in the immune system, now this happens in all cells, but in the immune system, these rafts are functioning as immune signaling platforms. Okay. Now, there's a lot of good chemistry that has been worked out on how proteins will partition with lipids into these immersible motile rafts. So you have hydrophobic amino acid residues, of course, associated with typically alpha helical transmembrane domains. And those will interact, as we've told you in previous lectures, with sphingolipids, such as ceramide, and also with cholesterol, right? The cyclopentanophenanthrene ring. Now, there are modified cysteines, remember those are going to be sulfhydryl groups, right? That are going to associate with certain saturated fatty acids like palmitate. And to be specific, that association with palmitic acid is typically with cytosolic proteins of the CERC family kinases, SFKs, don't you know? And you know where they're going to localize? To the raft inner leaflet. Raft inner leaflet. It's where you're going to find saturated fatty acids associated with these CERC family kinases. So that's because of a palmitylation of the cysteines. And that palmitylation of the cysteines, obviously, a post-translational modification, right? That's going to be found in transmembrane and in cytoplasmic domains of any number of membrane proteins that may or may not directly be in the flotilla, which is the membrane lipid raft, or simply interacting with the raft as its circuit is turned on and maintained because of mobilization to various endomembranous or plasma membrane fractions. Yeah. So, for example, in polarized epithelial cells, there is an apical transport of vesicles that are typically enriched in cholesterol and various sphingolipids. And you have N and O linked glycans, with some of those apically associated polypeptides. And that involves itself another sorting mechanism. So you have the hydrophobic hydrophilic interactions. You have hydrophobic interactions between aliphatic side chains of proteins with, of course, the aliphatic lipid domains in the sphingolipids or in the cholesterol. And then you have these anion-O-linked glycans, which are further permeating and interacting with ionic, non-ionic, and hydrophobic interacting mechanisms, playing multiple or multiple or even polymorphic roles in reorganizing the proteins with the different lipid fractions. Okay, so there's multiple types of thermodynamic mechanisms in play, and all involved in controlling free energy states, right? So the enthalpy of this system itself is just a magnificent symphony of interactions between lipids and proteins that is necessarily occurring in all cells. And we're talking now about immune cells, where the immune cells won't function unless this whole process is a priori arranging itself to deal with a potential for an APC, an antigen-presenting cell, to present a peptide on its MHC to the TCR, right? If this is a T lymphocyte we're talking about. And as it turns out, the glycans, because this has been studied, sometimes enhance the association of some of those apically destined polypeptides on the RAF surface. Now, sometimes the glycans work directly with those proteins, and sometimes they do not. Sometimes the interaction with the glycan is indirect, perhaps altering the mobility of the intact RAF, rather than a direct interaction with the polypeptide. You understand? Because the membrane RAF itself has its own mesodomains once the polypeptide is associated with the lipid, right? Interacting then topologically with the potential for glycans on the surface of other polypeptides, otherwise they're not directly embedded in the membrane lipid RAF, but nevertheless controlling its mobility. And it's another word I would use is fractionation into various subcellular domains, regions, right? And a lot of that is still not worked out, obviously, because it's a very complex process and it's going to be very specific. Now, where there are sites of infection or a lesion or injury, what happens when we're talking about an immune response? Circulating leukocytes are going to adhere to that, and they're going to adhere to activated endothelial cells and platelets and to other adhering leukocytes. So this is going to be one massive adhesion cascade. And by adhesion, then we're going to get to talk about tethering, right? Putting a leash onto these interacting cells, rolling, which now that a cell has been tethered, it starts to roll on the surface of the other cells. And then rolling is going to also start to slow down the movement of those cells, and that's called deceleration, right, in physics. And then ultimately an arrest of cellular rolling and movement. Then what's called intraluminal crawling. And finally, what's the last thing? Transendothelial migration. Okay. So proteins like selectins actually are involved in the mediation of the rolling mechanism, whereas the beta 2 integrins, well, what are those? They mediate the slowing down, the deceleration, and they also mediate the arrest and the crawling in quotation marks, mechanism. I didn't come up with these words, by the way. These are all in the immunology literature. I know I could be accused of introducing a lot of curious words, but these are not mine. These are directly from the literature. Now, selectins are lectins, of course, and lectins are typically proteins that interact with carbohydrates, as they were first described. But selectins are lectins that form a reversible force-regulated bonding with, glycosylated ligands. And that occurs under a flow dynamic, right? Cytoplasmic flow or extracellular matrix flow. Either one, depending on where you're discussing this, within the cell, right, once trans endothelial migrations occurred, or outside the cell. So both those things are occurring, again, simultaneously. So the leukocytes express L-selectin. Activated platelets express P-selectin. See the L for leukocyte, the P for platelet. And activated endothelial cells express P and E for endothelial selectin. Okay? So they express platelet type and endothelial type selectins. So the dominant leukocyte ligand for PNL selectins is the P-selectin glycoprotein ligand 1. Ready for an acronym? Sorry, but here you go. PSGL1. And we're going to need to use these acronyms because we need to talk about a lot of different molecular species here. Now, the major leukocyte ligands for E-selectin include PSGL1, CD44, and CD43. Although other ligands are also involved in the overall adhesive process. So, PSGL1 and CD43 are mucins. That's the kind of proteins they are. And mucins have multiple oxygen-linked glycans, O-glycans, attached to amino acids with hydroxyl groups, serines and threonines. Okay. Now, CD44 is not technically sensus stricto a mucin, but it's modified with both N-linked and O-linked glycans, nevertheless. So selectins bind, at least at some level, we mentioned this last lecture, the one before, to the sialic acid Lewis X mucin type O glycans. Okay, it's a particular type of carbohydrate. All right. Now, CD44 uses N-linked glycans, nitrogen-linked glycans, to interact with E-selectin. Whereas the PSGL1 uses the mucin type core 1 derived oxygen linked glycans to interact with all three of those selectins. Okay, the L, the P, and the E. Now, the enzyme core 1, which is beta 1,3 galactosyl transferase, which is going to move around carbohydrate moieties, forms the core 1 backbone. So what you end up with is a gal beta 1, 3 gal NAC alpha 1 serine threonine. Polypeptide carbohydrate molecular domain. That's all core 1 backbone it's called. Now added to that are more distal determinants. And they include a domain called the S-lex, which is added later. More on that later as well. Okay? So neutrophils lacking core 1, beta 1,3 galactosyl transferase, in the endothelial and hematopoietic cells, and these this in a mouse model, this is called the EHC-C1 GALT1 double negative, they have, what do you think might happen there? without that galactosyltransferase. They're going to be impaired in rolling on specifically the P or E selection.